Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing podcast.
Because fish haven't got eyebrows to cover their eyes when it's sunny, they tend to go deeper and in faster water. So a larger fly with a bit of flash tends, and dark colours, tends to show up better to a fish. What I don't try and fish it slowly, I fish it fast so that they'll just see it go past them quickly. And I tend to find that that gets me more fish than fishing something small and slow.
That was Stuart Foxel on his thinking behind steelhead fly selection. Connect Talk Kings, Atlantic Salmon, and Steelhead today on The Swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how are you doing today? Thanks for stopping by the show. If you get a moment before we get going here, it'd be great if you can share this episode out. Maybe look back in the back catalog if you've been listening for a while and share that favorite episode. Click that link down in your app and find a good person to text it to, send an email, whatever it takes. If you want to go the next level, try to share it on Instagram. We recently had a couple people share some stories out there on Instagram, so would love that. Would always love that. Today's episode is sponsored by Fishhound Expeditions, putting together remote Alaskan wilderness trips for that trip of a lifetime. These are not your lodge-style trips. These are not your car-style trips. This is remote, floating in, flying in at times, floating in down Alaska in the middle of nowhere, mousing for rainbows, camping out under the stars of the Alaskan sky. This is good stuff. We did a trip earlier this year, and it was amazing. You can check out these trips right now from Fishhound, wetflyswing.com/fishhound, F-I-S-H-H-O-U-N-D. Today's episode is sponsored by Drift Hook, who has pre-packed fly assortments for every stage of your fly fishing journey. Each kit is organized by species and includes instructional videos, easy-to-follow guides. Their fly shop quality flies are hand-tied and inspected before being packed in these careful, durable packs. And I can tell you, these are sweet little fly boxes. Check them out right now. Drift Hook, wetflyswing.com/DRIFTHOOK. Drift Hook. Stuart Foxel takes us into the madness behind his steelhead addiction. Stuart shares the story of his first trip to BC and how in subsequent years he found himself scrapping together whatever change he could to put together this long trip over from England, and found himself crashing out on couches, whatever it took to get that steelhead fixed. So this is a pretty fun story. We also find out about the Atlantic salmon or steelhead choice. Which one is the winner? Stuart digs into that. And then we also hear a little bit about his flies that he ties through aqua flies. And before we get out of here, we're going to hear a cool story about Stuart's mom and her passion and some of the amazing fish that she's got into over the years. So this is good. Some good family stuff, some good friends. It's all here. Stuart takes us into some good stuff today. So without further ado, here we go. Stuart Foxel from Stuart Foxel Flies. How's it going, Stuart?
Very good. Thank you, Dave. Nice for you to invite me to your show.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you making the time today to come on and chat a little about fly tying. And, you know, I think we're going to dig into some steelhead, some Atlantic salmon. You know, you've done a lot of traveling out west and you're over across the pond. And we're going to talk about that as well. Before we get into all that and how you got to where you are kind of in your fly fishing career, bring us right back to fly fishing. How did you first get started?
Fly fishing actually was me bullying my dad a little bit. my mom's family had always fished, but we've got something over here called coarse fishing, which is fishing for unsporting fish, so carp and fish like that, and fishing gear mainly, floats and ledgering, things like that. And dad took us up to Wales when I was about 4 or 5. Mom bullied dad into fishing, so dad started fishing and really took to it. So when I came along, I obviously had no choice in the matter, but dad took us up to Wales when I was about 4, and he was spinning for pike, funnily enough, and a salmon followed the spinner straight to his feet. And that got him into salmon and trout fishing. But once again, it was mainly spinning, etc., that we was doing. And then one holiday up in Scotland a year or two later, I saw some guys fly fishing. We was on the association water in the middle of Inverness, on the River Ness, and all I was doing all day was trying to use my spinner like a fly rod, practicing to fly cast. So dad sort of said, oh, I'm going to have to buy him a fly rod. And he bought one as well. And we sort of taught ourselves to fly fish from there.
Oh, wow. So you saw, and this is on the river, you said the River Ness?
Yes, where the Loch Ness Monster is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Loch Ness Monster. Nice. So, and when was that? Like, how old were you when you first saw that person?
I'd have been about 5 or 6. So that was 40 odd years ago.
Yeah, right. And when did you, what was that transition from there? You know what I mean? When did you get into it where you were just kind of addicted to that sort of, you know, I guess this is the long rods?
Yeah, it was long rods, obviously being small as well. We started off mainly on trout fly fishing and using single handers, and then progressed into double handers. But at the time then, double-handed rods, especially for Atlantics, were big rods. Yeah. I mean, I'm probably talking when I was 9, dad would have bought me my first double-hander, which would have been an old Bruce and Walker 14-foot rod, which that would have been classed as a smallish rod as well, which is why he bought it me. But I used that for years. You know, it's a great casting rod, good fishing rod.
Yeah, so it is interesting for me. I always like that, you know, we call it our, like, the transition to spay, right? How did you get into it?
Yes.
It's interesting here because we're a little bit later, right? And so up there, when, you know, I know you've done some spay recently, are people still, like, is it still the long, right? How is it different from that first time your 5-year-old kid seeing what they're using to now over there on the other side in the UK?
It has moved. There's definite trends. Certainly 20 years ago, you definitely saw a move towards smaller and shorter rods, which was obviously becoming popular because of what was happening in America. Sage coming in with their nice, shorter, lighter rods. And let's be honest, going smaller as well didn't mean that you was casting any less distance.
Yeah.
And it started to move a little bit longer again. Certainly in the last few years, I've started to see a trend towards longer rods. Certainly some of the Norwegians on their big Scandinavian rivers are getting back into 16-foot rods. Mm. And it's not so much for the casting ability of having a longer rod. To my mind, it's the mending capability and the more control that you have over your fly during the swing.
Right.
When I'm in Alaska fishing for kings, most of the Americans were fishing with 12 and perhaps 13-foot rods. A few were fishing 13-foot rods, but it was more 12s. And I always much preferred using a 14-foot rod there for the simple reason it just gave me a bit more control on my swinging capability.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, I love where we're going with this because, you know, I want to dig into the history kind of, you know, with the spay, you know, kind of Atlantic salmon, steelhead, but also you mentioned kings, right, which is huge because
that's one of those bucket list trips for a lot of people, right? Especially if they're thinking of Alaska. Let's dig into that a little bit on the King. So you've been up there, like you go to Alaska West, right? You've been up there a few times.
Yes. Yeah. I've been going for about 15 years. It's a bit of a long story, but my dad died at an early age. My dad was only 57 when he died. And that particular year, I always used to go skiing with my mom. And dad used to look after the family business while we was away. And my girlfriend, my partner, sort of suggested, why don't you take your mom away for Christmas? It'll be her first Christmas on her own. So I ended up going to Whistler. And being a fisherman, made a beeline for the nearest fishing tackle store, which was Brian Niska at Whistler Fly Fishing.
Yeah.
So we hit it off. We got on really well. I had a day's fishing in Whistler over Christmas. And I asked him if he knew of any fishing, and he mentioned about Alaska West. So that's the first trip that I did, was with Brian Niska.
Awesome.
And it was just amazing, an amazing place.
Right on. Yeah, we had Brian on in episode 370. We'll put a link in the show notes to that one. That was a really cool episode because he dug into steelhead. And currently, you know, there's a kind of a, you know, a downswing, right, in the populations around the Pacific Rim for steelhead. But he had a real positive outlook on it, actually, on where we're at and where we're going. You know what I mean? So I think we're seeing some of that. But cool.
I think certainly, I mean, Brian's a great guy. I've got a lot of time for Brian, but he is right. It's sort of self-fulfilling with fisheries. If you do think that there's no fish there, one thing is you have to talk yourself into going fishing anyway, as opposed to like making 10 trips to the river. You might only make one or two when you think conditions are right.
Right.
And then you also go with a bit of a mindset as well, where you're thinking, oh, I hope I catch a fish, as opposed to I'm going to catch a fish. Yeah. And there is a big difference. There is a difference.
Yeah.
To your results in that mindset. So I think it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, really, if you do get down on a river and runs. Don't get me wrong, there are problems. We all know there's problems. But equally, just saying there's a problem and not going fishing isn't going to put it right.
Right. And that is a great point. I think that, it's just like the having confidence, right? Steelhead or any of these species that are tough to catch, you got to come in with some confidence feeling like. And that's why if you've hooked a few in a spot, you're like, okay, I know this water pretty well, which is good.
Yeah.
So talk about Kings. I want to dig in this a little bit because, you know, I think there's some people going up. We might be going up this next year to fish for Kings. Take us into like that. What sort of, let's just start with the gear real quick. Like, what are you using for Kings? If you're, and is there a variation between, you know, hitting smaller Kings, or are you always using the same stuff?
I like to use the same stuff. It's probably geared up for larger fish. Although some parts of it might seem a bit on the weak side, but I like to use a 14-foot rod for the reasons that I've said. I can control my swing a bit better. Certainly.
Yeah. And is that like an 8-weight?
No, it's 9-weight. It's a 9-weight. I generally tend to overweight my rods a little bit for the simple reason it takes a bit less effort to cast the rod if I'm overloading it a bit. And it's also easier to handle the T14 tips. Your big flies.
Gotcha.
So that's what I tend to do because I know it slows me down a little bit. It's also easier in I do buck the trend a little bit in as far as I like fastish, stiffer rods as well, because when it's windy in Alaska, and it will be, you will have days where it's windy, it's a bit easier to control and cast those rods in the wind.
Yeah.
Some of the softer rods deliberately built for skagit, I have noticed that the wind can actually start to bend them, which doesn't sound that much, but halfway through a cast, there's always a part of the sweep where the wind is actually moving as fast as the rod is, and you just lose total load of your rod. And that's when you quicken up.
Mm.
And that's the last thing you want to do when you're spay casting is to speed up. So I like a stiffish rod, skagit lines. I actually like floating skagit lines. for the reason that we fish the tidal sections quite a lot. And there's a definite theme that I find on the Connectop River where king salmon there actually want to chase a fly. If you've got a very slow moving fly, you'll get less takes than if you're fishing a faster moving fly. So I like to fish my flies fairly quick. I like to be able to lead my fly to the bank, which is why I like the longer rod. We never use really heavy tips there because the fish are that aggressive. And it's really good fun because they really do nail the fly. There's not much plucking or plucking. It's usually bang and you're off to the races with them.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
So when you compare the take to a steelhead, how does that compare?
It does depend on the water that you're actually fishing. But I mean, I know years ago fishing with Brian, we always used to say that there was a theory that king salmon wouldn't take a strip fly. Well, that's a total fallacy. They like strip flies. Mm. You move that fly, they will strip it. And we've even used motips, certainly on an incoming tide, because the river slows down a bit on an incoming tide, which is part of the reason I like that floating head, because you can still get a bit of a swing and start to move your fly. We was tying booby flies.
Yeah.
Which are just basically foam tubes. And we were stripping, and you could actually see fish break out the pod of moving fish and chase your fly down. And you'd never get one fish. You'd get three or four fish charge at your fly. And we're talking like 20, 30, 40-pound kings chasing your fly. And we couldn't quite get them to the surface, but you get the big boil as they took the fly. We was probably about a foot down deep. And, I mean, then the fun was actually hooking into the fish and having loads of nylon running line round at your feet. And right. It was under that much tension. It was like tarpon fishing. You'd end up with line round your ears and head all sorts of fun. But, I mean, you know, it would only fish like that for about an hour of the tide. But, I mean, it was really good fun. But, yeah, those fish want to chase a fly down.
Yeah, they do. They do. Similar to, I always think of coho are the ones that really up there chase all the way to your feet. So it's kind of not quite that level, but they still are moving for it.
Yes. Yeah, they'll move some distance.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And the Connect Talk is interesting because that is a well-known, it's a well-known river, but is there describe that a little bit. Take us to the Connect Talk. Are there lodges on that river? Is Alaska West out there or who's out there?
Yeah, Alaska West's on there, which is where we've gone for years. I think I've been going for about 15 years. There's the Duncans up the top, who they mainly concentrate on the trout fishing there. But in all fairness, the trout fishing there is probably some of the best in the world.
For rainbows.
Yeah, and mouse fishing. I think the biggest rainbow that I've had off there was about 12 or 14 pound.
Wow.
As it happens, it took on a swung king fly. But,
nice.
Yeah, but you'll definitely be able to sight fish up in the braids with mouse patterns, which is just unbelievable fishing. And, you know, generally the average size is probably a couple of pounds, but every now and again you'll see one up there that's 4 pound plus. Really exciting fishing with a little single hander. And there's another lodge low down as well now that fishes mainly swinging for kings on there. But it's not a big river. It's not a massive river. It's got a good push and flow to it all the way through. Most of it, in fact, I mean, I spend all my time in walking, wading on gravel. It's easy wading, very easy wading. So it's good fly water. Every now and again, if you feel like it, they might fish you out of a boat on a big tide just to see if you can get pods of fish coming through. But, you know, that's your choice if you want to do that. But
gotcha.
Generally, that's not how we fish it. It's 99% of the time it's from the bank.
It's from the bank. So you're literally the same thing, like steelhead fishing, go up there, you looked at a place that looks like a good run, and then you're kind of swinging basically downstream and across to these guys?
You've got it, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What, and is it that hard if you go up there, you know, you're walking up the bank and you don't know where the salmon are to find a good run where they're holding? Are they pretty much in all the runs there?
They'll be in all the runs.
Yeah, they're in the deep runs.
Yeah. You probably, most of the time we're fishing for running fish anyway. So even above camp, which is, you know, we're probably talking 10 miles upstream from the tide, you can still catch fish that have got long-tailed sea lice on them off that morning's tide. So, I mean, there's lots of water to fish, and you're fishing for those moving fish, really, those really aggressive things. I actually really enjoy going downstream to the tidal water for a couple of reasons. A, the fish are more condensed. So instead of if you was upstream, you'd probably catch a fish every half an hour as the line of fish had gone through. But when that first come through on that tide, that the pods of fish are that condensed that literally you could have a fish every cast for an hour. As that pod's going through, and then obviously as it starts to slow down, then you can start chasing upstream if you want to. But there's something for me about fishing down there and thinking that the first thing that these fish have seen is your fly. That's just a bit of an exciting thing. And, you know, the way some of the fish do attack your fly, it is the first thing that they've seen.
Yeah, right. And give us a fly name. I know you've tied plenty of flies. Do you have one that would be good for kings that we could look at online out there?
Well, there's an intruder tube fly that I do, which is chartreuse and blue. I've found that color works really well for me in sunny conditions and dull conditions particularly. And if people sort of look at it and think, look, Christ, that's a big fly. Part of the reason we were tying flies that big really was, first of all, the takes that you get were the really aggressive smash takes that you got. But the other thing that we was trying to do was keep away from the chum salmon, because you could spend half your day up there playing chum salmon if you wanted to. So using bigger flies and not swinging right into the slower stuff at the side did keep you away from those chum.
So stay in the heavy. So basically, and that's where the T14 comes in, because you're fishing a little bit of the heavier, deeper runs, and you're getting down.
Yeah, you've got it. And the runs there come in definite bands, both sides of the river. On the inside, you'll have sockeye that are probably 2 or 3 feet deep. And there's lots of dollies in with the sockeyes. And on the outside of the dolly, you'd have chum, and on the outside of the chum, you'd have the king salmon running through.
Right, so you got everything. And you're talking, I mean, for kings, you're looking at kind of early July, right, is the best. Eventually, end of July, things start petering out. Is that how that looks?
On the Connect Talk, it's middle of June is the start of the run, and then it does start to peter out around the middle to end of July. Yeah,
middle of July. Yeah, that's right. So you got that big blast of Chinook coming in, and that's awesome. And then the T14, so is that pretty much, if you had to grab a tip for your Skagit, the T14, like T11, is that kind of what you're using the whole time?
T14 would be my go-to. Once again, it's probably because of the water that I sort of gravitate to. There's definitely some guys that like to use some fists or some intermediate Skagit heads with heavier tips and heavier flies to really hit the buckets, which they tend to do better in low water years.
Oh, gotcha. So they'll just use the fist without adding a monster heavy tip.
Yeah. And it's just to slow it down so that they can hang those flies down in those buckets for a bit longer.
That's cool.
Yeah. So once again, although it might sound as if when I say hot, a busy day with fish, it might get a bit boring because you'll catch fish after fish. It's not, because you can experiment and try different things. And you know, if for a thinking fisherman, it's a great place to be, because you do see you do see the results of trying to fish in a different way.
Yeah, I think that is a great tip.
Yeah, you'll soon pick up whether things are working or not. It's as opposed to fishing somewhere where there's perhaps not so many fish and you're scratching your head thinking, well, is it working or is it just that there's no fish?
No fish. Yeah, I gotcha. No, I love that. That is a great reminder that, yeah, I mean, these fish can be easy to catch. Sounds like Chinook, you can get into a pod and it's like one after the other, but then you could, right, throw on a booby and see how that works and test and try some stuff that's fun.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've even skated dry flies on a dry line there for Chinook on big pushes. And I've never actually hooked one, but you've seen bow waves behind the fly. I've had boils at the fly. They're definitely interested in it. I'm sure if you persevered with it for days on end, you'd probably get one.
Yeah.
But I mean, you'd be losing out on catching a huge fish.
That's amazing. Yeah, you probably know some of the guys. We've had a couple of interviews where, you know, a couple of these steelheaders are like dry line, you know, dry fly on the surface only, even during the wintertime. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's just this, which is what's cool about fly fishing. You know what I mean? You take it to that level and you get bored. Well, try something that's harder. And then, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
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 Today's episode is sponsored by Zag.Fish, who was founded with the idea of finding ethical solutions to fly tying products and services. They've done just that by creating jobs for marginalized people, both in the U.S. and abroad. They've got everything covered. We've had a recent episode on with John Grosta, who talked about some of the great products they have with the fishing he does in Florida. With the Fairflies brushes, they've got the 5D brushes and their fly fur, which is pretty amazing. Tons of people are loving this stuff for its durability and the speed that allows you to tie flies. John talked about that on the podcast, and he said that just basically it's going to add on at least 15 to 20 minutes to each fly you tie if you're not using these brushes. Zag also has Wasatch custom angling tools in their satchel with over 50 custom heirloom tools that go along with your materials. So they are a true do-it-yourself company, and you got to check out Zag.Fish right now. If you want to, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/Zag, and you can get 20% off your first order by clicking through that link. And let them know you heard of them through this podcast, and you'll get that 20% discount right now. That's wetflyswing.com/Zag, Z-A-G. Okay, back to the show.
Let's take it back to more of the, you know, I want to think Atlantic salmon, you know, steelhead and that comparison. So taking us back, we were talking about the long rods, and it sounds like there's a transition back. And I think in the U.S. there's a transition a little bit to some of the upper level guys back to the longer rods, or at least getting into a more. So what does that look like now for you? So during your year, just take us there. Are you kind of splitting your time like half, you know, Atlantic salmon, half steelhead, or what do you do out there?
Well, certainly when I first went over steelheading, I had the steelhead bug in a really bad way. It was going to be a one-off trip. Once again, I went with Niska. I absolutely fell in love with it. I was lucky that Brian introduced me to some really good guys, so they give me little snippets on what I could be doing to do it on a cheaper holiday plan, which sort of helped because I'm not made of money. So,
no.
So that first year is actually why I started selling flies. As soon as I had a few thousand bucks, I'd be on a cheap flight over to BC, and I was steelheading, and some of the guys were good enough to put me up on the sofas and stuff like that, just so that I could go out and walk the rivers and fish rivers. So I think that first year I went four times to British Columbia steelheading. So I mixed my time for a few years. I didn't go salmon fishing in Scotland, but now I'd do last year I did about 2.5 months worth of salmon fishing in the UK. I managed to do 2 weeks in Alaska, and I did 10 days in BC, I think. steel leading.
Gotcha.
So, I had a really good mix last year. And that might sound, once again, as if I made money, but a lot of the Atlantic salmon fishing that I had was rolled over from the COVID years. So I basically had 3 years' worth of fishing in 1 year, which was great.
Yeah, that is great. And that is kind of the challenge, right, with the salmon fishing, whether it's Scotland or anywhere in that region, is that it costs money, right? This is not it's kind of a pay to play.
Yeah, it's expensive. I think with the way fuel's going as well, just to drive up to Scotland takes quite a bit of money now compared to what it used to. But just so that you guys know, over in the States, we have private water in Scotland. So what you have to do is basically buy the right to fish a certain beat, which is allocated to you. So that's your beat. You'll know how many people are fishing there depending on the beat. Some beats might have 12 people. If it's a big beat, some of the smaller beats will have 2. So that makes it a bit more expensive. The other thing that it does is, because you have to pre-plan and book your fishing in advance, you might not actually have very good conditions.
Oh, right.
So it's just a toss of a coin, yeah. But, I mean, you're booking it a year in advance, so you don't know whether you're going to have water or dry conditions or whatever. So, but once again, for thinking angler, just if you haven't got good conditions doesn't mean you won't catch. You just have to change your tactics. And I know it was August, I got invited to a Highland River in Scotland, and the water had gone. It was on its bare bones, and I was just fishing a little 6-weight single hander with little hitch tubes. And when I say little, probably 1/4 inch long hitch tubes and size 12 single hooks, and was still moving a lot of fish and hooking a lot of fish. I lost most of them because of the size of the fly, but it was still good fun.
Right. No, that's awesome. And tell us, so if somebody was over, you know, somewhere around the world, didn't really know, and wanted to go to Scotland and really do the Atlantic salmon thing, is there a, you know, like a law, you know, what would you recommend for somebody? How could they get in on this if they're kind of outside and, you know what I mean, they want to fish?
If you was outside and you wanted to go and fish, the one thing I'd say is we have 4 big rivers, which are classed as the 4 big rivers in Scotland. And they're classed as the big rivers because they're that big. Generally, you don't need a spate or a bump in water to bring fish in, which are the River Spey, the River Dee, the River Tay, and the River Tweed. Those are the 4 main ones. Now, years ago, to get on those rivers would be really, really difficult. But because catches have changed and runs have changed, and they have become more spatey now as well, you do need a bump of water to encourage a run of fish, really. But what that's done is actually opened up some of the beats that you couldn't get on before. So there's a website called FishPal.
Oh, yeah.
What you can do is call on there and see what's available on any given river in Scotland. If the beats are allocated to FishPal and they've got slots there, you can look on there and book on there. So the one thing I would say to you guys, if you do fancy coming over, is hedge your bets a little bit. Years ago, what you would have had to have done was take a beat for the week to fish on a beat. So what you can do now is get your day bookings or 2-day bookings on some of these beats. What you could do is fish 3 different rivers in a week and hedge your bets. And the one good thing about that is if you're fishing one stretch of river for a week and you know that you haven't got much chance, it can be soul destroying. But if you're fishing different rivers and different beats throughout your week, you can still enjoy it because you've seen somewhere different, fishing a different stretch. And I don't know about you, but even if you're catching quite a lot of fish, sometimes you wouldn't want to fish it all day every day. You'd want to go somewhere else. So you know, it's available now that you can, if you stop somewhere in between the River Spey and the River Dee, you could actually do 3 days on the Spey, 3 days on the Dee, and you know, you've seen the best of both worlds there.
Mm, that's amazing. Yeah. So fishpal.com is a great resource. I'll put a link in the show notes. It looks like, yeah, they have like yesterday's catches. They got the river levels, all that stuff.
Yeah, there's updates. Yeah, there's updates on there. There's the Highland rivers as well, which are very spatey type rivers.
And spatey, by that means just like you're getting a big flush, like a big high water event coming in.
And as soon as that bump of water comes, you can get numbers of fish. So, I mean, some of my best catches over the last few years have been on the Highland rivers when you've actually hit them right. When it's not right, I won't say that you won't catch fish. But like I said, if you adapt different techniques and go into trout fishing mode, you will pick up salmon by fishing smaller flies and being tricky about it, much like you do with steelhead. But finessing it a bit when the water's low, you will reap benefits. So even the Highland rivers are worth having a look at as well. And some of those rivers aren't quite so expensive to fish either because of that lottery on whether conditions are going to be good or not.
Oh, I see. Gotcha. So this is cool. So basically it's allowing people, even kind of the normal people that don't have, gazillions of dollars to go fish. I mean, you could literally get out there and get on FishPal and probably set something up. If you were even traveling with the family, doing a week or a couple weeks over there, you could probably find a spot to fish.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, to be honest with FishPal now as well, it would be a great family holiday to go to Scotland because there's lots to see, castles, lovely beaches.
Yeah, right.
There's lots to all the distilleries, the food's really good up there. So there's lots of things to see. And if you was a selfish fisherman and fancied having a day or two away to go, you can pick up, decent fishing for not a lot of money, and if nothing else, you'll be fishing in a nice part of the world, and you'll enjoy it just for that.
Yeah, exactly. And what's the time, just so we know, timing wise, when would be a good time to hit salmon?
Well, here's a good one. Our salmon fishing, some rivers begin in January, believe it or not, which is classed as jokingly as spring fishing, but it's actually winter. The majority start March, April, March. And then some of the rivers finish in September, but some of them, like the Tweed, can even go into November.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so you get a whole big year.
Yeah, I mean, this year, like I said, I've done a lot of fishing. I actually caught fish every month of the year from February. I started fishing in February, and I had four Feb fish.
Oh, wow.
And I've caught fish every month of the year. I actually stopped in September because I thought that the conditions of the fish in the UK last year, that started to colour up, and they've been through quite a long period of no rain, which stressed them out a bit.
Yeah.
So I actually stopped fishing, but I caught a fish every single month of the year, including September, and I didn't bother fishing in October. But the majority of the catches are at the back end, which would have been October time, but you will be catching stale fish.
Yeah, right. That's the whole thing. So earlier it could be colder, but March would be good because you got fresh fish in and maybe the weather's starting to get a little better.
You've got it. Yeah. Well, all these rivers have slightly different run timing. So just do your homework. And if you fancy picking a river, have a look at when the runs are. A lot of the rivers, this is very general. A lot of the rivers, the main runs appear to be now spring rivers, you'd say April and May, and then summer runs and grills would be July, August.
Yeah, July, August. Okay, perfect. And no, this is good. We're getting a little perspective on this now with Atlantic salmon. And for you, I mean, we've talked a little bit about Atlantic salmon over the years, but let's just take, say you could fish anywhere, you don't have to pay to play or whatever. You could just fish for Atlantic salmon or steelhead. You know, you have to choose one. Which one are you choosing?
Oh, I'd be really greedy and want both.
Yeah. Is that a tough one?
It is a tough one.
Because they're very similar, right? I mean, like BC, those are summer steelhead too. So they're very, are they similar? Yeah. They're pretty similar, right? I mean.
They are very similar. If the hard bit to both those species of fish isn't actually the fishing bit. The hard bit is having fish where you're fishing. That's the hard bit. Yeah. I think better anglers make most of their opportunities, and if there's some stale fish that have seen a few flies, the better anglers have usually got an ace or two up the sleeve that they can
coax them in.
Yeah, they've got slightly different techniques that perhaps the fish haven't seen before, which gets them
taken. That's cool. Yeah. Is the Skeena system, which is a big river, I'm not sure what the CFS is, but compare that to, say, one of the bigger, like the Spey or the Dee. Are there any similarities?
No, there's not. The biggest river that the UK's probably got is the River Tay, which is in Perthshire. And I would say that you could probably fit the River Tay three times into the Skeena.
Oh, gotcha. So it's more like it'd be like the Bulkley or one of the Tribs.
Yes, yeah.
Which are good rivers, which are definitely good rivers. They're not just gigantic Skeena. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then back to that question. So you can't answer it. So if you had to, let's just say it's equal number, 100 fish in a run. They're both Atlantic Savage, Steelhead. Which one do you choose?
I think my choice would probably be on which side of the bed I got out of on that morning. But there is something about Steelhead. I've got to be honest. There is something about Steelhead that for me, even just saying the name makes me smile. It excites me.
Right. It is interesting because for me, you know, and again, it's like we're changing the things. I'm on the other side over here and I haven't done any Atlantic salmon fishing, right? So that's on my bucket list. But, you know, for me, so that's exciting. I'm like, I've caught lots of steelhead and I still love steelhead. I mean, I'd go out, you know, today and do it, but I still have that Atlantic salmon. Like it's new. I'd love to try it just to see because they are very right. They're moving for things. They're taking stuff. It's cool, but okay. Well, yeah, it's not an easy one to nail you down on, but I think we all love it. And obviously it's whatever's in front of you. You know, like you said, carp, I mean, carp has become right. An amazing fishery for lots of people around the country.
Yeah. I mean, I was bored up catching gudgeon in a canal at the back of my house, float fishing with maggots for gudgeon. And I mean, for a certain amount of time, that was absolutely fantastic. And I won't say that I'd plan my life around going carp fishing or after gudgeon the way that I used to as a kid. And I obviously plan my life around my salmon fishing a bit now and steelheading. But I still enjoy the odd day of going out with a float and catching coarse fish. It's really good fun. Takes you back to being a kid again, which I think sometimes with a lot of anglers, that's part of the fun. You go out, you've got no worries in the world. Probably the hardest decision you've got to make all day is what fly shall I put on. It's just good fun. Takes you back to being a kid.
That's right. That's right. And no, it is. It is great. I think just getting on the water is a huge part of it. So where are you now? So you're located. Where's your location?
I'm in the Midlands of England, very close to a city called Birmingham. So I'm probably as far away from any good fly water than you could be.
Yeah, you are.
England. I am. But everywhere I can get to, I can get to the test down in Hampshire. I can fish all the Welsh fast flowing rivers. I can fish there within a couple of hours. I can get to North Wales. I can get to North England in 2.5 hours. So I can get everywhere within a day. And I do. I do an awful lot of trout and grayling fishing. And they're all because our countryside is so varied. So I think it makes you a slightly better angler fishing different places.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you're not just doing the Spey, you're mixing it up throughout the year, doing some single hand stuff.
I mix it up. I mix it up.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, talk about your flies. So you, I know, have a lot of flies you're tying out there. You've tied a lot over the years. Give us a little rundown of flies. So if we're going to either go for steelhead, well, let's talk about that. Steelhead versus Atlantic salmon. Are you pretty much, are you using the same flies for both species?
No, I do mix it up. I'm probably most associated steelhead-wise for a fly I did called a pot-bellied pig, which when I first started steelheading, I sort of asked, once again, I'll go back to that confidence thing and feeling confident in what you're doing. I'd caught a load of salmon, Atlantic salmon, using a fly called the pot-bellied pig. So all I did was I asked Niska, what sort of colours do I need to tie my flies in? And he gave me a list of colours. So I came up with a black and blue and black and purple pot-bellied pig tube pattern. And at the time, 15 years ago, not many people was using tubes over on the Pacific side at all. And I just thought that they... I like tubes because being a destination angler, instead of having a box of small flies, box of medium flies, box of big flies, depending on what the water's doing, I like tubes because I can just tie them one size and just stack them if the water's high and put two or three tubes on. So it saves me a load of hassle with flies. But yeah, so I'll just copied this pot-bellied pig and did them in black and blue and stuck a hot cone on. Because obviously I noticed that steelhead seem to like egg-sucking leeches and similar flies. So, and I think that first day that I used that, I hooked 7 steelhead, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Didn't land many, but I hooked 7. But, yeah, so because of having confidence in those flies, I think people would probably be a bit disappointed if they was to see my fly box because there's not that much choice really.
Yeah. So you got, and describe that pot belly. How is that? Describe it from the back, from the tail and how you tie it.
From the tail up. Well, it's a plastic tube. I put a tag of Mirage tinsel on the tag so that, there's a bit of glint, I put a black cock hackle, large black cock hackle as a back station. Put a tail on of black bucktail with blue crystal flash, and then put some lung feelers on of pot-bellied pig feelers, which they're pretty stiff fibers and they kick in a current.
Gotcha. So this is a pot belly. This is literally pig, hair.
That's it. Yeah.
Kind of like almost like a horse hair or something like that.
You've got it, yeah. And it's pretty stiff. So they look like feelers at the back, and then it's just black steely dub, sorry, blue steely dubbing body, very short, ribbed with silver. And then I'll put blue or purple cock hackle on the front with a mix of red, blue, purple, mirage, flashaboo. So that flash really pulsates in the softer water. So although it looks a fairly stiff fly, that flash is what gives it the illusion of pulsating in soft water. Jungle cock eyes and pink or hot orange cone to look like a egg-sucking leech or whatever. And I'd say probably 90% of the steelhead that I've caught have been caught on that pattern.
Gotcha. There you go. So we got it. And you obviously you can tie that in different colors. What's your,
yeah,
is that your favorite, the one you describe? Is that kind of your favorite one for steelhead, that color?
Yeah, blue and black, purple and black. I do a lot of pink as well. I know a lot of rivers are generally, like the Dean, are very influenced by pink, so pink works well. Actually, the Skeena in spring fishing for winter steelhead, that pot-bellied pig in pink works really well as well. And it's not a heavy fly, and it's certainly not a big fly either. And I think that's part of the reason that it works so well. It's easy for people to turn over when they cast, so they're fishing straight away. They're not waiting for tension to arrive on the line so much. And if there's taking fish, it does tend to find taking fish. There's no two ways about it. I've followed some guys down fishing, intruders who've probably had one or two bumps, and then I'll go through with that pot-bellied pig behind them, and I'm fishing no better than them. It's just that it's a smaller fly. And
gotcha.
I've caught two or three fish behind them.
Yeah.
And I think the way that we set up a swing fisherman, which is cast three steps down, cast three steps down, I think sometimes the fish can see the fly too well. And unless they're super aggressive and move 15 feet to slam your fly, by the time you actually get close to the fish, they've seen the fly that many times that they switch off. They know what the fly is going to do, which is just go on the dangle and then be pulled away from them. So they've lost that chase. Whereas if you do move down quicker sometimes or show them a smaller fly so that they don't see it till it's really close to them, that's when you start to get more takes. That's just my my thoughts. I'm not saying that is definitely what happens, but...
No. And what, and by smaller fly, what would that be for that tube? What would a small tube be for like a hook size?
Yeah, the overall tube with the cone, the way that I like to tie them is probably just under an inch.
Under an inch, yeah. So you'd be like...
Yeah, so the overall fly with the length of the feelers is probably 2 inch at best.
All right, for the whole with the whole thing. So you're an inch. So you're tying almost like a comparison on a fly would be almost like a little size 6 or an 8 or something like that.
Maybe,
versus a 2.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So that makes sense. So you're going small, and then like in so describe that when you put the, your like setup for steelhead. So when you're using these tubes for somebody that hasn't used tubes before, maybe they've used a lot of traditional stuff. How does that work? Describe the setup.
Well, the reason I like tubes more so than shank flies, when I first went over, obviously everybody got shank flies. So I was looking at these shank flies, and I'll be honest, a few fish were hooked outside the mouth, especially when using Dacron as the link. So the tube, what happens with the tube is you'll thread your line through the actual tube. You've tied your fly on the tube, which could be plastic or aluminium or metal. You thread your line through that tube, and then you tie your hook on. And I like to use straight eye hooks for steelhead. And that straight eye actually sits in the behind of your tube, which basically means that once again, you can tie a biggish profile fly with a small hook so it doesn't damage the fish. And as soon as you hook into a fish under tension, that tube rides up your nylon leader out of the way of the fish's mouth so it doesn't cause any leverage when you're playing the fish. All you're actually doing is you've got a small hook in the fish's mouth so that's not doing as much damage as it might do. Even with the wire links that I saw used on some of the fish, you could actually see where it had cut fish's teeth away.
Oh, wow.
While you was playing fish. So I sort of got off those pretty quickly. In all fairness as well, I've got confidence in tube flies anyway, because that's traditionally what we use over here. But it's quite nice to see now the amount of anglers who are using tubes, because, as I say, I do think that they're the way that you can tie them and the way that you can use them, they're a far more flexible way of tying than using shanks.
Yeah, using shanks. And then, and one of them is just, you know, whether you tie it on the type of tube, right? Because they kind of, right, if it's plastic, it might float a little more than, say, a metal. How do you have that? What's your box look like so you make sure, you know, are you adjusting that to get the fly down a little more, or are you just using your lines really to focus on that?
Well, most of the fishing where I would use tube flies, I'm using sink tips anyway. So what I like to do is use lighter tubes, so plastic or aluminium tubes, and I rely on my tip to actually get my fly down for me, not the weight of the fly. And the reason I do that is, if you can imagine, your tip will drag that fly down to the depth that you want to be, and then you can start to lead your fly out. But any little hydro or movement of current will actually influence that fly because it's light. When you use heavy flies, which sometimes you do need to use in very fast flows and etc. What I've tended to find with very heavy flies is as soon as it comes out that fast water and into the softer stuff that fish will actually be sitting in, it's that heavy, you lose movement of the fly,
right,
it drops. So that's why I like to prefer to use lighter flies and rely on my tips to get me down as opposed to the other way around.
That's awesome. No, I love that take on it because that is a... So it's kind of like, yeah, your thing is sitting up there. It's almost like neutrally buoyant. It's just it's getting more action, and then your sink line. Basically, your sink's getting you down in the zone, and then your tube. And then the other cool thing, like you said, is that you could literally go from a tiny little speck or throw on a few tubes, and now you got a big profile pattern.
Bigger right? profile, exactly.
Easy.
Yeah, easy.
How do you? What's the hook you use? Typically, you said the flat. And so, what's there? Why do you use a? Because a lot of people I know use, especially with shanks and stuff like that, or any like the bait or what's it called?
The up eye hooks.
Yeah, the up eye. Why the straight?
The reason being that I use straight eye for steelhead is I don't want the hook to be too far back. I don't really get an issue with steelhead. I think in all the years I've steelheaded, I've caught one fish deeply on a tube fly. I've caught fish with stingers, and as once again, particularly Dacra, pretty deep. So that's why I've moved away from that. Now, funnily enough, when I'm Chinook fishing, what I do there is I'll thread my line through the tube and I'll, using a surgeon's knot, I'll create a loop at the back of the tube fly, so the knot will sit inside the tube, leaving a loop so that I can use an up eye hook. And once again, I use owner up eye hooks, size 2 out or 1 out for Chinook, and then I'll thread it through and set that up like a stinger so that the hook's a bit further back with Chinook. Once again, I think I've only ever hooked one fish deeply by doing that. But when I was using straight eye hooks, don't ask me why, I definitely used to get lots of bumps without hooking onto fish. Whereas when the hook's further back with Chinook, I tend to get better hookup rates than the other way around.
Today's episode is sponsored by Country Financial. The fires in the Northwest and throughout the West in the last few years have been devastating for thousands of people. Some folks have lost their homes, their belongings, and their sense of safety has all been challenged. This is why insurance and protecting your assets are so critical. Dalton at Country Financial is here, and he was on the front lines during the fires, handing out checks to Country Financial community members, providing drinks, food, and more. And each time Dalton meets up with a client, he does an extensive review of their current assets and coverage. This is his opportunity to really decide and let you know what you need to make educated decisions for your insurance needs. This is a super critical piece, and Dalton Roy loves it. He loves getting out in the rural community, connecting with people, loves the outdoors, fishing, hunting, everything that goes with it. And so I'm excited to be sharing Country Financial and Dalton with you. The unexpected will happen, so it's always best to make sure your assets and life are protected. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/country right now to get started. That's C-O-U-N-T-R-Y. Check out Dalton and support this podcast and a great local company right now.
Well, and let's go back to the tradition. That was a good, you know, the tubes. I think that is definitely way more popular, and it makes sense. It's not maybe tying them, right? Is give us, before we jump back into some history real quick, like tying tubes, how challenge, like for somebody new to it, what sort of tip would you tell somebody if they're starting to tie tubes?
Well, it might seem difficult to tie on tubes if you've never tied on tubes before, but it's very easy. It's very simple. And the one thing I would advise people to do when they start to tie tubes is, if you was to start fly tying, Dave, I'm sure that you wouldn't jump straight into tying an intruder, because
no.
It's a difficult fly.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that most people that struggle with tube flies, the first thing that they try and do is tie a complicated fly straight off the bat. So choose a simple fly, something like a hobo spey, something like that, that's really fishable, catches a lot of fish. It's not like it's not going to catch your fish. And just dip your toe in it gently by tying a few tubes, hobo spey flies. They're fishable. You can stack them. If you're not sure on colour, you can have a dark colour and a bright colour on top of each other. It's a really good way of filling a fly box up quickly, and you know they're going to take you 5 or 10 minutes. And once you're confident on what you can do with tube flies, then you can start to go into more complicated patterns and temple dogs and Scandi style, and all the rest of it. But you know, we make fishing complicated. The fish don't. I'm sure that sometimes a fish wouldn't care if it was a bunny strip floated in front of its nose or an intruder that took over an hour. So, you know, it's horses for courses. It's always nice to catch a good fish on a beautiful fly that's taken your ages to tie. So that's why we do it.
That's right.
But yeah, it doesn't need to be that complicated.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be. No, that's good. I love this. So, well, let's just jump real quick back into the history. I'm not sure. Do you have a good take on the history? I mean, again, it's the spey, right? We had we've had a number of episodes where we talked about in the U.S., the evolution of spey, right? Where you had this period of, you know, in the 70s, 80s, there was some stuff going on, but really late 80s, early 90s, it really started picking up, you know, George Cook and people like that. Do you know, like, the history, if you look at kind of the UK and that whole spey? I mean, because that is literally, right, that's where it began.
Well, yeah, it started on the River Spey. I'm sure that there was definitely other rivers where they was doing waterborne casts to get the fly out. A lot of rivers, to be honest, what a lot of people don't realise when they look at the history of British salmon rivers, actually, a lot of the gentlemen and lords and ladies that was fishing at the time hadn't used to fish much after March or, May or June anyway, because they'd start hunting.
Oh, right.
So a lot of the rivers would be springtime, so it was cold water, which is why they'd been using those big heavy irons, those singles, to get the fly down.
Oh, right.
That's where that came from.
You mean like the double hook sort of thing?
You've got it, yeah. And a lot of them would be fishing from boats as well, so there wouldn't actually be that much casting done.
Oh, wow. No kidding. So fishing from boats. So would they still be using a big spey rod too?
Yeah, they would, yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. So people aren't really doing that over there.
Well, not so much now, no. And if you actually look at Norway, because obviously all the English lords would go over to the Norwegian rivers after their big fish, some of the Norwegian rivers still fish in that manner, trolling a fly rod around.
Gotcha.
With big, heavy tube flies. But, you know, same technique, just newer tackle.
Right. And trolling, literally like in a boat, just trolling their flies.
Yeah, they'll flick it out, and then the boat will actually pull it out of the current and then back into the current, making sure that all those lies are covered.
Gotcha.
So the spey casting, just for people that don't know, was greenheart, and then they moved on to bamboo rods. Some of them could even be 18 foot long, believe it or not, with long belly lines of 90 feet.
Yeah.
Something like that, really long lines. And if you wanted to get that fly down, you would have to either use a very heavy fly or iron. The hooks were actually called irons because they were that heavy.
Nice.
And if you think about it, you'd need a big rod to set a hook like that. So it was all a perfectly balanced outfit, in all fairness.
Yeah.
And the rods probably sound as if that was heavy, but they'd be using a big hardy perfect, heavy hardy perfect. So everything would be balanced out. And then it's moved on to shorter fly lines. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever used one of those giant, like 6-18, like those old, something like that?
I tried to cast a 17-foot rod only about 4 years ago, something like that, and a really long belly line, and I couldn't do it. I have done it. I did it years ago, but I've just got out of the timing of it. So, no, I was totally pathetic with it.
Right. So you're...
Seemed far far too much like halibut to me. No.
Exactly. So you don't do as much of the long belly stuff versus like the skagit, that even with like when you're Atlantic salmon, when you're fishing for salmon over there, are you doing like the long belly stuff?
Not longer bellies, but certainly not long bellies. I tend to use Scandi lines, but fairly longish Scandi lines, but you still wouldn't call them a long belly line at all. But there's times and places for it, which, you know, I'll fish the Barkley a lot. The Barkley would be a great river for using a long belly line, and I have used a long belly line on there. Big casts, it can swing right the way across the river, and you can pick fish up from when you first cast it all the way across to your own bank. And like it's a few strips in and boom it out again. You know, the river fishes the fly for you, and that's where the long belly works for you, when the river fishes the fly for you. I'm sure that you're probably aware that there's not actually that many places like that where the river does the work for you for all day.
That's right.
And that's why I like the Scandi lines. It just gives me a bit more flexibility so that I can strip flies or work flies or put big bellies in lines to speed the fly up, etc.
Gotcha.
Or slow it down.
Perfect. Well, let's stay on that fly and let's take it out of here. Start to take it out of here with the some flies, because I think, is it aqua flies you tie for?
It is. Yes, I've been with Doug for a number of years now. So I've still designed for Doug. Yeah, aqua flies.
That's awesome. Yeah. So if somebody wanted to go right now to Aqua Flies and pick up some patterns, would you have a list? Maybe, you know, some flies for steelhead and salmon, or give us a few that we can kind of pick up if we're interested.
Certainly, if you go on his website, all of those flies will catch fish.
Yeah.
So confidence-wise, I'm very much of the opinion. Years ago, when you used to go fishing with a guide or a ghillie over in the UK, the ghillie would always say, let's have a look in your fly box.
Oh, right.
And he would pull flies out and say, right, we'll try this.
Nice.
I don't know if you've noticed nowadays, I don't do that. I tend to say, what do you want to put on?
Oh, right.
Because it's all about confidence. So honestly, if you're confident in a fly and you think it looks right, you stick it on. Because if you think it looks right, you'll fish it as if it's right.
Yeah.
And more than often, you'll get fish.
What if it's like some crazy like chartreuse? You're kind of with a person, they pull out a bright chartreuse fly. They're like, this is the one I like. Are you going to, that's going to be just as good?
Well, it really is. I know, I mean, chartreuse is not a color that we use in the UK. And probably 4 years ago, something like that, I met the head ghillie at one of the top beats on the River Spey. And his top fly was a bright chartreuse thing for the spring. And it was a Pacific fly. It was. And there's no way, if you was to show that 99% of the ghillies on the River Spey, they'd have just looked at it and thrown it back in the fly box.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all down to confidence.
Yeah, it's confidence. Cool. All right. Well, that's good. Well, we'll just say head out to Aqua Flies and take a look at some of that stuff. And you mentioned one, I'm sure, the pot belly, right? That'll be a name that'll be on there. Yeah.
Yeah. A few bits of information that I think is advisable is for steelhead, because a lot of the rivers at steelhead run can be milky or murky, I like flies that have contrast. So what I mean by that is I like a dark section and a light section to the fly.
Yep.
So I like that rather than one plain color. Right. I do like that. Yep. I like dark colors and larger flies when it's really sunny. And the reason I like that is because fish haven't got eyebrows to cover their eyes when it's sunny, they tend to go deeper and in faster water. So a larger fly with a bit of flash and dark colors tends to show up better to a fish. What I don't try and fish it slowly, I fish it fast so that they'll just see it go past them quickly. And I tend to find that gets me more fish than fishing something small and slow.
Gotcha.
So that they're just a few tips that work for me. I'm not saying they'll work for everybody, but it certainly works.
No, that's awesome. I love that. Well, and take us out here with the, you mentioned Brian Niska. It sounds like he was a big influence getting you going on the steelhead. On the Atlantic, Sam, do you have a person you'd give a shout out to as kind of a mentor, somebody that helped you really dial things in there over the years?
To be honest, no, because we hadn't got the money to fish the famous beats, et cetera, when I was young. We tended to just, well, no tend about it. We fished on our own. There's lots of water where you can get fishing with a cottage, holiday cottage. And so we'd never had gillies. I'd never had any casting lessons.
Oh, really? So you've taught yourself all your cat, basically, never a lesson.
Yeah. And to be, until I started to go to certain places where that were influential places to go and fish, I'll say.
Yeah, like later on.
Yeah. People never even saw my flies either, because I only tie flies for myself. And you don't know whether they're great flies or bad flies. They're just good enough for you, which is what I, that was good enough for me. And it wasn't until people started to see my flies at other, and they'd be like, oh, that's a really nice fly. You're really good. So, you know, if you're self-taught and you're just going around with the same people, I mean, I'd read every book going. So there's a number of people whose books are followed religiously, like Hugh Foulkes for Atlantics and Sea Trout.
Oh, right. How do you, that, let me write, get that one. So Hugh, I've heard that before. How do you spell that last name?
Hugh Foulkes. It's F-A-L-K-U-S.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And he did a great book on sea trout fishing, and he did a great book on salmon fishing as well. And obviously Roderick Haig Brown's books were fantastic. And he was the main reason why I thought, when I have got a bit of money, I'm going steelheading. It was through his books, which I read when I was a teenager.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So there you go. Yeah. So Haig Brown, that is so cool. Yeah.
And everything that he'd built in my mind about steelhead and the places you go to fish for steelhead, he put it in, he did it far better than I could ever put it into words. It really was that good.
Gotcha. You know, I want to, it's hard to wrap, I'm having a hard time wrapping this up, but I, steelhead wise, because this is good. So your first steelhead, do you remember that fish, and can you take us there, like that first fish you actually hooked into, landed, whatever?
Yes, it was. I was fishing. The guide was Scotty Baker McGarver.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I'm not kidding myself. I've fished with some of the best guides going. So I was on a real fast track with steelheading. I really was. So we was fishing a run, and I had a tendency, I guess, to keep on wanting to cast out to the farthest water, which is what we do for Atlantics mainly, because salmon tend to sit on the outside of structure and rocks, whereas I've always found summer steelhead in particular tend to sit on the inside of structure.
Right, right, because they're heavier. They can be bigger fish too, right?
Yeah, like a big lazy trout, that they're on the inside of structure. Yeah. So he kept on drumming into me for the first hour. You make sure that you cover the inside as well. And sure enough, it tightened, and it was only a chicken, probably 5 or 6 pounds, but it was literally within the first hour of the trip, and it just took the weight off my shoulders. So that was amazing. It didn't do much. Really, but it was a memorable, beautiful little fish.
Wow! And was that what river was that? A secret river?
Or that was on the River Bulkley, below Trout Creek. Because at the time, the canyon there used to be only done by drift boat and rafts, and now there's a few jet boats going there.
Oh, there's some jet boats.
Yeah, at the time it used to be just rafts. So that was a fantastic experience for me being British, because obviously we don't have this history of rafting down rivers and doing that sort of fishing. It was eye-opening. It was fantastic.
Amazing. Yeah. We'll put a link. I actually had him on the podcast in episode 17. We're coming up to episode 400 now. So that was... the interesting thing about that is that he has this great quote in it, which was, I've got it right here on that blog post, ankle deep and 20 feet. We catch so many fish within 30 feet of the shore that it's unbelievable. So that was that was his quote, and that's exactly what he said to get you into your first fish.
Yeah, it's exactly what he did. And there really is something to it. It's amazing. The first thing that I do when we've got people in Alaska, like I was saying about those columns of fish that come in different bands, if your first guy going down a run wants to wade out to his knees to cast, all he's doing is pushing all of those bands of fish 10 or 15 feet deeper into the fast stuff.
Yeah.
And the sockeye will push the chum out, and the chum will push the kings out. So you're making it really hard for yourself.
Gotcha.
There's no need to go wading up to your tits anywhere.
Most
of the time.
Most of the time.
I'll say most. I'll put that in.
Yeah, that's right. Occasionally, yeah.
Yeah, occasionally, yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, no, I fished up in BC a couple times, I guess, and you know, it was, I mean, those are the things, high banks sometimes and stuff like that. And you're just sitting there, on the bank casting out long casts sometimes. But no, that's cool. And it's interesting because that was back in 2018. We had Scott on, and off air when we were getting started here, you had told me that your account was hacked. And this is a fun fact. Like, you probably would have been on the episode probably in the first, not long after Scott. He probably even mentioned you. But I sent a DM out to you on Instagram, and I said, hey, how's it going? Just want to see if you want to come on the podcast. And you respond and said, oh, hey, you know, whatever. But I just learned that you told me that actually Stuart Foxhole, you were hacked. So that Instagram account, literally somebody has hacked it and is responding as you, but your actual Instagram now is Stuart Foxhole Flies.
That's it. Yeah. That's me. Gotcha. Yeah.
So we would have had you on a long time ago if it wasn't for that hacker that basically thought you didn't respond to me. So good.
Yeah. The other good thing about which I learned, and no doubt this is part of the reason why Scotty says this as well, is if you're actually wading shallow, you get a faster swing into the bank.
Oh,
and
right.
That last 10 seconds of swing is probably where you'll hook up a large proportion of your fish. Now, if it's static, you'll get a lot of hang down takes. Whereas if you give yourself just an extra couple of seconds of swing, that hang down take will be a more aggressive take. So instead of getting your splash and fish on, fish off, you'll end up landing a greater proportion of those takes.
Yeah, that's another good one. So, and by depth, you're thinking, you go out to run that typically steelhead, you say, hey, whatever, knee deep, somewhere in there is your typical like depth, 3 feet of water they hold in, right? But you're saying, you're not standing out in that water. You're actually standing down back, like Scott was saying, kind of ankle deep or even out there a little bit?
Ankle deep or perhaps knee deep, something like that. It really doesn't need to be, unless you can actually see structure and there's a lie and you need a big cast and
you're trying to hit.
Yeah,
I love that. It's such a good reminder. I have a buddy, Greg. This is always he's a big guy. He's like 6'5". He's my old basketball, we were on back in the day, but he can go deeper. You know what I mean? He could go, and he always feel like he's always trying to get out deeper. I'm like, Greg, you're literally, I'm coming behind. I'm 6 feet, right? So I'm coming behind. I'm like, dude, you're out in the spot, like past for the fish, right? So I'm always making and again, he's caught fish obviously doing that. But I think that, like you said, we could all probably step in a few steps in and be okay. Just cast if you need to, 5-10 feet longer.
Yeah, I still fish a lot with my mom, and she catches a lot of fish. And obviously, she's in the 70s now, so she doesn't wade so deep. She's a really good caster, but she obviously can't cast as far as somebody like me, who's 6 foot and fairly muscly, can do. Yet it's funny how some of these older ladies can consistently catch more fish than anybody else. And there's a reason they fish what they can fish, and they fish it well, as opposed to pushing yourself and trying to cast 100 feet and all that sort of nonsense, which all men do. I fall into the trap myself. We all do it. But there's a reason why women catch fish consistently.
Yeah, love that. And I'm perfect. I'm glad you took it out with your mom, because that's where we started this episode, right? You actually got into fishing. Your mom actually got, and I love that because it's one of those things where sometimes, you know, well, again, even like in Scotland, some of these places, you hear about these things where there's not as many women fishing on some of these beats, right? It's still kind of a male focus. Yeah. Do you see that up there in England? I know in the U.S., we are seeing a big change to more women and more diversity. Are you seeing that over there too?
I am and I'm not. The one thing that I have an issue with the ladies pushing fishing is it's obvious that some of the prettier girls are getting a bit more focus on social media than perhaps some of the other girls who are great anglers, but they're not getting the sponsors that perhaps their fishing warrants or their guiding warrants. Now that's, I can certainly see in the UK that there's a bit more interest in some of the prettier girls than some of the fishier girls, I'll put it that way. But it's quite ironic that we hear this as a narrative that there's not so many women involved in fishing as there should be. It's funny that the two record salmon, rod caught salmon, fly caught and bait caught fish in the UK were caught by women.
Oh, wow.
And that was Victorian times. So,
yeah.
And Edward. So have women never fished? It says to me that they probably have done.
Yeah, there are. They're just not getting as much notoriety and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing is years ago, this is just going back onto traditional literature. Nearly all the writing was done by gentlemen, English gentry, who didn't have to work for a living, so traveled around all the best sporting estates shooting and fishing. I don't think women would have gotten away with that years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
And that's why there probably wasn't so much written about it, but there was certainly a lot of women fish. And even if you look at some of the fly names associated with some of the rivers, a lot of them are named after women that was fishing. Mm. So Lady Caroline, Lady Florence.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was obviously a lot of ladies fishing.
Yeah, definitely. We did an episode on the kind of women in fly fishing, the history with Jen Ripple, and she went into a lot of that going back hundreds of years and saying just what you said. There's you know, all sorts of examples of women, you know, books and obviously huge things. Yeah. So it's one of those things where it's hard from the male perspective to see kind of exactly what's going on, but I think you're right. Yeah, there's a lot more than we know of.
Yeah, backtracking a bit, I think it's really good that there are more ladies fishing and that there's a lot more notice. I mean, one of the best guides, I've fished with Adrian Como on the Skeena. I've fished with Whitney Gould in Alaska. I mean, they won't actually call themselves lady guides. They are fishing guides. If you speak to them, they will say, we're fishing guides. This is what we do. This is what we love. And they're bloody good at what they do as well. There's no need to throw the women bit into it from my point of view.
Yeah, I like that.
And from theirs, that they just love it because they love what they do.
Yeah, perfect. Well, I think that's a perfect way to leave that off. Like we said, talking about how your mom got you into it and how, you know, it's really not about like some, you know, sexism sort of thing. It's really just about fishing, right? We're getting out there and having a good time, whether you're fishing for salmon or Atlantic salmon or Chinook salmon or steelhead, which is what we've kind of talked
or
about
gudgeon.
Today. Or what was your other one?
Gudgeon and carp.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, or some of those other species, which are great, too. So, All right, Stuart, we'll send everybody out to Stuart Foxhill Flies on Instagram if they have any questions for you or want to connect. And, I want to just say thanks for all the time today. I've really enjoyed this perspective, right? I mean, I think you probably have more crossover Atlantic salmon steelhead experience than anybody maybe we've talked to so far. So, thanks for all your time today and look forward to keeping in touch with you.
Thanks very much, Dave. Really enjoyed it. And thanks for inviting me. It's appreciated.
So there it is, wetflyswing.com/391. 391 is going to get you some links and show notes and everything else you need over there to get a head start on your next big trip. Maybe you're chasing steelhead or salmon, or maybe you're going for trout. Whatever that is, why don't you reach out to me and let me know. We recently had a nice shout out from, this is on Instagram, not underscore Micah Garma on Instagram, who gave us a big shout out and a story post. And he also mentioned that he wanted to hear a couple of Northern California episodes and guests that he would love to hear on. So we're going to put that together for not underscore Micah Garma. And we're going to make sure to get down the line in 2023 some of those episodes. One of them is pretty good. It sounds like there's an interesting story about a skateboarder mixed in there somewhere. So we're going to do our best to get on that. If you get a chance, you want to give a shout out for this podcast, do an Instagram story, give us a shout out. We will definitely put together an episode for you, some content. You just got to reach out to me, do that, or send me a DM and let me know. That would be great. And if you can add some music in there, that's always a big bonus. That music kick I got going, I just recently, I'm kind of a late follower, but I signed up on Spotify. I've been loving Spotify for a while because of their dedication to the podcasting, but they obviously have a ton of music, and it's pretty awesome to have now that that wide selection of all the good music there. So we're going to be listening to that now. If you get a chance, we are heading out, actually this weekend, heading out to Ohio to meet up with Jeff Liske and the crew, and we're going to be doing some steelhead fishing. So I would love to get out with you on an upcoming trip. If you have an idea for a trip, you can always give me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com, or you can just check out what we have going. We have a trip coming here soon, a trout trip that is right around the corner. So we're thinking Euro nymphing. If you have an interest in that, you can jump on that and let me know, and we're going to be filling some slots to get out and do some nymphing, probably on the west, probably starting out on the western part of the U.S., and then we might migrate across to the east side. All right, check in with me anytime, dave@wetflyswing.com, if you have any questions or need anything, and I am going to get out of here right now. So, hope you are having a good evening, a good morning, or a good afternoon, wherever you are in the world, and I look forward to catching you on the water very soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.